Okay, can you tell me your name? Can you spell it, please?
It's Christine Binney. That's Christine, and Binney is BINNIE.
Thank you. And your date of birth?
3855.
Brilliant. And can you tell me where you lived in the area? Was it
I lived
Leytonstone?
in Dyers Hall Road, and with Grayton Perry, or in what was then his studio. And I think it might have been 159, but maybe he can remember, if you want a cross-reference. And I also, after I'd been evicted from there, I lived in Grove Green Road with Graham Miller and Mary Lemley.
Okay. And when did you do you know when you moved to the area, the date?
I'm not sure if I do. I know it coincided. I moved to the area at the same time as I was having an exhibition in Brick Lane of pottery. So it might have been 1990. Does that sound about right?
I don't know.
But it was. Oh, you. No, you wouldn't know. I could always kind of work it out and tell you another time.
That's fine. And do you know when you moved out of the area?
It
Vaguely.
was whenever the big eviction was from Claremont Road. I don't know
The
if you know the date for that.
very end of it.
Yeah.
That would be November, December 94.
Was it that late? Was it 94? Okay, well, it was then.
All right. So you were there right at the very
Yeah,
end, were
yeah,
you? That
yeah,
point where
yeah.
everyone was thrown out.
Yeah, the big, the really
Yeah.
big eviction
Well,
with
that's
hundreds and
interesting.
thousands of police.
Yeah. No, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, it would be really interesting to hear about where you lived, the house where you lived,
Okay.
and its construction,
All
and
right.
what changes maybe you made to it,
Okay.
and
All right. Well, I moved into what was Grayton Perry's studio. He didn't live there anymore. And he had. The reason I moved in is because he did used to go out with my sister, and they actually applied for the house together. But by the time the house came through, they'd split up. So he moved there on his own. And then, when I needed somewhere to live a couple of years later or whatever, he had actually moved out of the house by then and was just using it as a studio. And so I moved into the house. And I didn't do anything to the house. And he hadn't done anything either, really. So nothing really was done to the house. We didn't do any home improvements or anything.
and no disimprovements.
No disimprovements. And it was. But it was a good place to live, and it was one of the things I can remember about the house was grit between my teeth, because Grayson did a lot of firing, and you shouldn't really live in a place where there's a kiln firing, because it produces all this kind of dust and stuff. So when he fired the kiln, it made my bedroom nice and warm, because my bedroom was in the room above the kiln, but I always had this kind of gritty feeling in my teeth, and it wasn't very nice.
And so the kiln was in the
Yeah,
house,
in the
the
front room.
in
His
the
studio is the front room, and my bedroom was the room above it.
right. And did you have a garden as
We had a
well?
tiny garden, yeah.
And but you didn't really use that in
I
any
did
way?
use the garden. Probably the most I did to the house was actually to the garden, because when I moved in, it was just a pile of rubble. It was loads of. Grayson decided, I think he was at the stage when he decided he had to be selective about his pots. There were loads of smashed pots in the garden. But I think I kind of gathered them all together, and then I think I, yeah, I think I remember planting things in the garden, so I actually did stuff to the garden. And I didn't make it into a wonderful oasis or anything, I just made it so you could sit out there without feeling too depressed, basically.
And what did the area like at the time? What were your sort of key memories and sort of senses about it?
One of my key memories was that when I got off the tube at Leytonstone, I really liked it because I could hear birds singing. I really liked that. Mm. And when I'd only lived there for a week or two, there were cows walking down the road.
Yeah.
And I liked that too, and they'd come from Epping Forest. Yeah. And after having lived, well, I mean, I'd lived in Hackney, and it wasn't a, and there were trees and stuff there, but Leytonstone felt like the country compared to Hackney. I almost felt like I'd moved to the countryside.
How extraordinary. But I mean, can you tell me a bit more about the houses and the people and the area in terms of...
When I first moved into the house, there were a few... Now, when I first moved into the house, most of the houses were lived in by artists or squatters or friends of artists who'd taken the house over that weren't really artists. And there were one or two kind of original residents in the road. And then there was, you know, a few empty houses as well, so it was a mixture. So, I mean, the atmosphere of the place was quite nice. It was quite sort of free and easy and relaxed. And sort of interesting. You kind of wondered who lived in the houses.
Mm.
Mind you, I always wonder who lives in houses in where I live. But and it had a kind of... It had a sort of bit of a rundown feeling in the sort of way that I like, you know, sort of buddlier, going across the pavements. And yeah, one of the things that I remember about it is sometimes it was hard to walk up and down the road on the pavement because bushes had got so big and gone right over the pavement, and I really liked that. Mm. And I just like the establishedness, the established feeling of something growing in a wild way. And it had that. There's a lot of things growing in a wild way in the front gardens. What else was there? I remember that... Well, I suppose it's because I'm just thinking... When I first moved there, I suppose it seemed quite bleak. Because I didn't know anyone at all, apart from Grayson, but he was never there at the same time as me because it was his studio and I went out to work quite often. Yeah. So, and I did see him, but when he was there, he'd be working anyway, so he'd say hello, maybe have a cup of tea, and that would be it, really. And it was all a bit, you know, there's all these houses around the people, but I suppose I felt quite isolated, really. But then I had always had this desire to do something, to join the Green Party or do something properly committedishly green, and I'd never done it. And then one day, and that's it, and I got to know this man called Hippie Dave. I don't know if you've heard about Hippie Dave. No. Oh God. Hippie Dave. When I lived in Hackney, I met him outside my house, and I think he was trying to break into the basement of the house or something to squat it. And he said, do you know anywhere I can move to? And I was friends with Mary Graham Miller and Mary Lemley, who also lived on the route. And I knew that the house next to them was empty, and they'd said, we need someone to move in. And Hippie Dave seemed sort of okay, so I said, oh, why don't you go and live next to Mary and Graham? And so he went and moved into their house. He turned out to be an absolute nightmare. Drug dealer, children as prostitutes, the lot. But to start with, I thought he was quite nice. Well, you know, go round of an evening, have a spliff type of scene. And so... that's what I did, being a bit lonely in the area, thinking he's someone I knew, and then Mary and Graham lived next door, and I could sort of combine the two, you know. And through going around there, I met a few local people, who were people who they weren't artists. They were people that lived there or were squatting.
Mm.
And I met this woman called Angie.
Oh, yeah.
And she... And I can remember one day I was just in the house in Leytonstone, and thinking, oh, I must take the dog for a walk, because I had my dog Prince living there too. And this kind of procession went by, and it was probably the first ever M11 Link Road
right.
event, or one of the first on the street. And she sort of said, oh, why don't you join in? And I thought, actually, it's a nice sunny day, I want to take the dog for a walk, why don't I? So I did. And in a way, I think it's one of the best things I ever did, because it meant I became part of the protest.
Yeah.
And before that, I wasn't. I was just a lonely artist trying to sort of work out who I was.
Mm.
And then I just joined in with this thing. And then after that, basically, I devoted, well, you know, at least a year, maybe more, of my life to the protest.
Right.
And just got to know all these people. So really, the people that I knew around were much more the protesters and the squatters than the artists.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And did you feel that there... And maybe this isn't the right time to ask the question, but did you feel that there was a distinct difference between the artists and the local community? What was your sense about that sort of interaction?
I felt like there was a three-way thing.
Right.
There was the artists, there was the local community, and there was the squatters and protesters.
Yeah.
And that there was a certain link between the squatters and local people that the artists didn't quite always join in with. Sometimes they did.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a link between the artists and the squatters. And then there was a link between the artists and the local people, but that somehow they didn't all gel
right.
as one.
Right.
And I suppose just different people had different links. But say like Angie and Claire, her friend, and those people, I think in a way they linked in with the local people. They were squatters, but I think they linked him with the local residents sometimes more than the artists did, because they were kind of more working class, I think, and the artists tended to be more sort of middle class and just concentrating on their art and not so sort of out and about and on the street.
Mm.
So there was a feeling about the artists that they kept themselves removed.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the fact that I was breaking that thing about being an artist, and I was being an artist, but I wasn't keeping myself removed.
Yeah.
I was throwing myself into it.
Yeah. And do you think that had an impact on your work?
Yeah, I think it did. I think, I mean, the other thing that was going on in my life at the time is that I was really involved in anthropology and a group called RAG, that stands for the Radical Anthropology Group.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all to do with these theories of anthropology that are to do with the human revolution.
Right.
And how we became to be human in one bang, like 200,000 years ago, or whenever it was. And that was like a fusion of music, speech and art and ritual all happened at the same time. And it was very much to do with the theories of the Radical Anthropology Group, the importance of strikes and protest.
Mm.
So in a way, being at the M11 gave me a chance to sort of test out some of the stuff to do with that, which also, you know, fed into my art.
Mm.
So it was kind of to do with that, really.
And what sort of work were you producing at that time?
Well, the stuff I did that I can remember doing that was to do with the M11 was lots to do with red ochre. And because red ochre, according to this theory and other forms of science, was the first art material ever used. And according to this theory, one of the reasons it was used was because of its similarity in colour to menstrual blood. And so, you know, in Africa you get these, they've discovered red ochre crayons that they think might have been used for body painting. I don't think they would have been, because I think it would have been far too hard and uncomfortable, and it would be not easy just to get a load of earth and sort of smear it on or water it down and paint it on. But anyway, it doesn't really matter, because just the idea of red ochre is the thing. And but the idea behind this theory is that it's very complicated to explain it, that menstruation and women's menstrual cycles and the cycles of the moon coincide. Mm. And the cycles of the moon also dictate the cycles of hunting. And so, and then hunting also involves blood. And so it's all to do with the interaction between these things. And it was to do with women banding together when they had their periods and saying, and that blood meaning no. Mm. And saying to the men, no sex, we're covered in blood, which is red ochre, really. Uh-huh. You've got to go out and get some meat and bring it back, and you're not allowed to cook it. You're not allowed to cook it until we've made it so it's not bleeding. So they had to bring it back to them.
Right.
And that was kind of, as part of this theory, that was the original protest.
Yeah.
And so I did a lot of stuff to do with red ochre on the M11. Mm-hmm. And actually, something I did do to my house, you know, the day before I was going to be evicted, I actually painted, you know, a lot of the house with red ochre on the inside and tried to make it as scarily menstrual as possible, so that so that when the eviction men came in, I was just trying to kind of give them the spooks in a menstrual kind of way as much as I could. And I wrote things all over the walls about Boadicea and witches and things like that. And I spent a lot of time thinking about spooking out eviction men. You know, getting to those men, their deeper psyches, the ones that were coming to knock the houses down. How could I get into their dreams? How could I give them a nightmare or something about knocking a house down?
That's interesting. And do you think you were at all successful in doing that?
Who knows? I don't know.
And what about work that you were doing for yourself, which maybe wasn't related to the M11?
I don't know if I was. I can't actually remember what it was when I was doing. I was probably doing a few performances, but I suppose in my mind, the neo-naturists was very separate. And I was doing other things like drawing and probably the odd neo-naturist performance. I think I probably even went to Latvia during the time I was at the M11 and did performances in Latvia and got an Arts Council grant to go to do a research project in Latvia about Latvian folk stories.
Sounds good.
The Latvian oral tradition and these songs that have got all sorts of information, but that had menstruation behind it.
Right.
It was and ritual. It was all sort of menstruation and ritual and mothers and lines of people, and folk stuff as well. So I was doing stuff during that time, but I can't really remember. When I think of living in Leytonstone, the work I was doing for myself, I just have to look it up. It doesn't come back to me immediately.
Right.
But what does come back is the stuff I did there that was about the road.
Right, right. And that would be that one sort of period that you were talking about with Mag and so on. Did you ever have any sort of visits from galleries or anything of that sort at all?
No, honestly, up until last year, nobody ever showed any interest in my art. Really. And it's only because through Grace and Perry getting more famous,
right,
and being interviewed for his catalogue for an exhibition he had before the Turner Prize.
At Barbican?
No, in Amsterdam.
Right, yes.
I had an interview by, do you know Andrew Wilson?
Yes.
Yeah. Andrew Wilson interviewed me and my sister, and he just wanted to talk about the neo-naturists. I thought he'd just want to talk about Grayson.
Mm.
But, and then he was so interested in the neo-naturists, and all the things he said about the neo-naturists were so positive, and he said, oh, you should write a book.
Mm.
I was just really surprised that anyone was slightest bit interested. I'd kind of, you know, I'd almost given up by then. And so after that, I started filling in funding application forms to try and get money to write a book, which I didn't get.
Right.
But the good thing about filling in funding application forms is it makes you get your thoughts together.
Yeah.
And so it made me think about it a lot. And in the end, my sister and I decided to get a little kind of portfolio sort of presentation thing about the neo-naturists together that we could have to give to people. And then, and it involved talking to Andrew Wilson quite a lot during over a period of a couple of years and saying, oh, will you sign my, will you be one of the people on this form that says I'm, you know me or whatever, you know, and asking him for contacts of things and running ideas past him. And then, so he, then letting him know that we'd done this book, this little presentation thing. And I think it's because he knew that existed and because we were still thinking about the neo-naturist, that then that's led on to us having these sort of about four exhibitions in the last year, really.
Right.
And it only started off with him interviewing me and me realising there were people interested in the neo-naturist, and I didn't think there were, really.
Yeah. Could you say a little bit more about the neo-naturist, maybe how it came to be and the sorts of work that you were doing? Because obviously you're saying you did some performances in the area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the neo-naturists started off in about 1980, and it came out of a combination of me being Wilma's life model at St Martin's, and like, and when I went in to be her life model, to be, she would paint me. So rather than being painted as an, on a canvas, she would paint me. And that came out sort of by chance because we happened to have some body paint. And it also came out of me being a life model. And then combining with my sister and Grayson, who also by chance have been doing a bit of body painting in Portsmouth and getting together and, you know. Oh, and also because I was a security guard for the Hayward, at the Hayward Gallery. During the time there was a performance art exhibition on in about 1978 or something like that, and I didn't even know what performance art was. So, you know, I'd just done pottery at art college, and so I went along and I had to be a security guard for this exhibition, and I just thought it was brilliant, performance art. And I just thought I wouldn't mind having a go. So after that, I was sort of trying to think what I could do with performance art. And then this body painting came along, and I thought, oh, yeah, performance art.
And that was your first encounter with...
performance.
With Wilma.
Was at St Martin's,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then how did it progress from there, the neo-naturists? How did that...
And then we just started doing performances. And I don't know quite how we started off with the ideas of the sort of things we did. I think they kind of just came out of those sort of conversations that you have, where you say, wouldn't it be good if you did that? Wouldn't it be good if you did that? And, ooh, yeah, oh, yeah, I'd really like to do that. And just sort of having a bit of a laugh and then really making it happen.
And was there a lot of planning behind all of that? Or?
There was quite a lot of planning. There was a lot of preparation. We'd had lists before performances, a lot of lists. And we used to do these little sort of charts about how, you know, what you had to do when. And we always had a piece of paper plan that we took onto the stage with us, because even though we planned it, we never rehearsed it. And I don't think we did that consciously. Mm-hmm. So it was about, it made it into like a ritual in a way, because it was a series of things to do, but no rehearsal. And there were elements of church in it, because my sister and I both had quite religious upbringings, and so it was kind of somehow, you know, in church services there's an order of service, and I suppose the choir rehearses, but say you're the girl guide that has to carry the flag up the aisle, you might get a chance to try it out once if you're lucky, but really you're sort of standing in the back in this church, and suddenly this huge flag is plopped into this huge kind of lanyard thing or whatever they call it, and you have to somehow walk up the aisle carrying this flag and sort of looking all somber and sort of ritualistic. And it was something to do with all those things that was in the performances too. But by the time I moved to the M11, Wilma had left, my sister had had a baby, and we were still performing, and there were other people involved in it too, but it wasn't such a kind of, you know, every night type of thing as it was in the early 80s. Because in the early 80s, it was like what we did full time for about 2 or 3 years. Now I look back at my diaries, but I've only just realised that that's what I was doing.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and so really, I think when I lived in Leytonstone, I was quite depressed. And I was doing quite a lot of jewellery making, piecework jewellery making, which was quite enjoyable because it enabled me to just go into a trance and think about things. And that's how I was making my living and being on the dole at the same time. I don't know whether that should be on it. I'm not sure. It probably doesn't really matter. And I carried on doing my jewellery making. It was actually quite useful as part of being a protester. Because I could just go and sit somewhere for hours and have something to keep me busy and not get bored and know I was making a bit of money at the same time. So I could sit there, you know, say we thought the someone was going to be turning up or something, but it could be any point over the next few days. I could just sit there and make jewellery and be keeping myself busy, making a bit of money, and then raise the alarm when I needed to.
It sounds a good lifestyle.
Yeah, it wasn't bad, particularly if it was sunny and I could be outside.
And sort of, so I was just thinking about, you've talked a little bit about what you produce at that time. Can you think that you did any performances in Leytonstone?
Yeah, I did. I can remember doing a performance that wasn't actually in Leytonstone.
But during that period when you lived there?
And it was at the class war march. And I just wasn't going to go. And I woke up that morning and I thought, I've got to go. And I just suddenly had this vision of myself there's a performance art classic where people have many breasts. There's quite a few people that have done it. And I just suddenly could see myself as a many-breasted woman at this march. And so I grabbed my bag of red ochre, dashed to Soho or some gift shop, bought myself like about 4 pairs of false bosoms, put them all down my front, smeared red ochre all over myself, and went on the march.
And what do people think? What was the response that you got?
It was anything from to "oh, brilliant." But I liked sort of facing the police with something like that. It was part of my thing about sort of spooking people out and facing them with something. And I did another performance that was actually after the M11, but it was at another protest where I just put a bit of gaffer tape there and a bit of gaffer tape over each bosom to make it look like the censored, you know, in Soho they have censored little black bits on the rude bits. I put gaffer tape on the rude bits, and I've got photos of me sort of dancing in front of the rows of police, all covered in red ochre with these things on me. And some other people did it too, so that was like a sort of group performance. And that, so that had elements of neo-naturism because it was the body paint angle.
Yeah.
And I can and so a lot of the stuff I did, because the thing about neo-naturism, it was all about the group.
Yes.
Bonding as a group, really, even though it took me, you know, it's taken me 25 years to work all this out, but probably at the time of those protests and doing the radical anthropology classes, it was, you know, I was starting to really think about it. And so neo-naturism went from being a cabaret sort of performance art thing. To thinking about what the process of getting ready was, or what we were doing.
Mm.
What we were doing was the next stage to think about. And then I realised the sort of ritualistic angle of it. And then I sort of moved on to thinking about the sort of bonding angle of it, or and the sort of protesting angle and the connections between bonding and protesting.
Right.
And so, in a way, it was experimenting with those things that kind of came out of it and were kind of part of it, but it wasn't the neo-naturists. It wasn't the neo-naturists in the sense of the group of people that
yeah.
had been. It was more me taking the ideas forward in my own way. So another thing I did, we did a march with Platform, you know, Platform, the do sort of environmental art stuff. Yeah, they were involved in the M11. I don't know if you've talked to them.
No,
they didn't live there, but they used to come and do performances and stuff. And I did something with them. They had this really long banner they'd made that somehow talked about the river. What was it? I can't remember what it said. Would you rather if this place was a road or a river or something?
Mm.
A really, really long banner. And I walked along at the beginning of the procession and I just sprinkled red ochre all over the road. So then it got trampled in as people walked on it, and then it meant that the whole route of where we walked was like a river of red ochre.
Nice.
And then in the art house, there was a puddle by the front doorstep that was always there, this puddle, and except in summer. But then I used to fill it up, because as the puddle was always there, I always put red ochre in it every day.
Mm.
So then when people walked into the art house, they trampled red ochre all around the house, and then it came out of the house and went all up and down the street. And in the summer, I used to fill the puddle up and put red ochre in.
So maybe you could say a bit about your time with the art house, because how important that was to you, or your artwork protest, how it came about, maybe.
It actually came about, and it was someone else's idea, and I can't remember his name, and maybe he's called Tom something. Have you spoken to him?
Tom Hunter?
Yeah, maybe it was him. Mm. Have you spoken to him? Mm. Okay. Yeah, it was his idea, really, and he wanted to do art at the M11.
Right.
And I can't remember whether he wanted to do an art house, or he sort of got in touch with the M11 and they put him in touch with me because they knew I did art too. And anyway, we did this art house. And the art house was rooms. And some people took a whole room and did it themselves. And some of the rooms were more like kind of galleries where there was different art by different people on the walls. And basically, I suppose I was curator. I curated the art house. That would be the modern word, although I didn't think of myself as a curator at the time. And I did some of the art in the art house too. I did the toilet.
Oh, yes.
Which was, I was very pleased with, actually. And I've got photos of all this, but the toilet was, it was an outside toilet, and there was just a really nice feeling when you sat on the toilet. It still worked, and you could sit there with the door open, and you could just see trees and things, and you knew you were in London, but you could sit on the toilet with the door open and see trees. And you could have the door half open. And I had all this gold leaf that I happened to have because I'd had this job with my sister gold leafing this nightclub in London. I mean, there was loads of, we managed to pilfer loads of gold leaf. And so I put gold leaf on the back of the door and I just wrote little poems in it about just, I can't remember what the poems were now, but they were about just imagining the future, really. And sort of the contemplation of sitting on the toilet. And there were actually leaves on the floor around the toilet, and I gold leafed some of the leaves, and they were just on the floor, so you could go to the toilet and there would be gold leaf leaves on the floor, and I gold leafed the toilet seat as well, and I loved the toilet. It was a very enjoyable experience going to the toilet in the art house. And there was a lot of red ochre, so it's a lot of red ochre in the house as well. And we did I did wax body prints on the walls of the art house in the corridors, so covered my body in Vaseline, I think it was, right. Pressed myself against the wall and did a sort of red ochre wash over the top, so you know, yeah, body just came through. And I had some of my pots there too, and made little sort of ritual-y corners and stuff. But if ever you see any pictures of the art house, have you seen any? Have you noticed what the floor looks like? It always looks kind of grimy, and that was the red ochre.
Okay. And was it a fun time, or what do you think about that time now when you think back?
It was sort of fun. It was kind of serious and traumatic as well. It was fun because you could do things like that. It was traumatic because a lot of the protesters weren't really interested in art at all. I was trying to use art as part of the protest to open up the whole thing about what protesting is and experiment with art and experiment with protesting both at the same time. And it was sort of to do with energy as well, like, you know, art opening up your feelings and when you're a more feeling person, how then that affects you as a protester, and if you're stronger, or, you know, all those sort of things, the sort of things I was thinking about. But there were just a lot of very angry and out of it people around as well. And I remember there was a cut-off point for me. Something happened. They decided to put nets at the beginning of Claremont Road, beginning and end of Claremont Road, so that people could be on top of the nets when the police came in or whatever. And they just decided to put the nets sort of as in the art house somehow. And they did something like just smash down one of the rooms of the art house wall without even asking me. And it was this horrible man called Scouse Mick, who I really didn't like. He was the first person I ever knew. No, the second person I ever knew who had a mobile. He'd sit on the roof going, on his mobile, like he was really important. And I was just really upset that he hadn't even asked, and that no one had asked me or had any conversation with me or any of the people involved about doing that. And then it was not that long after, or maybe even before, but within a few weeks of that, there was a big march. Maybe it was that same march in London, the class war one.
Right.
And then after that, millions of people came back to Claremont Road. Mm. Loads and loads of people. And suddenly the protest took on a different angle.
Mm.
And suddenly I didn't really enjoy joining in with it anymore.
Right.
And I sort of gave up on the art house at that point.
And what period of time was that?
That was the summer before the big final eviction, I think.
Summer 94?
I think so.
Right.
Oh, it might have been even a year before that. Might have been a year before that. The timescale of it is all very strange in my mind. But, Yeah, so I flung myself into the protest quite a lot. But I suppose it got to the point where I felt like I couldn't do protesting and art at the same time anymore in the way I wanted to do it. I couldn't kind of, the group got too big and too sort of taken over by other people to have any feeling that I could sort of be part of it and even sort of known. And so I still did things, but I just had a different feeling about it. Whereas before that, I felt very much part of it.
Right.
And felt like people knew who I was and we could kind of do things together. And then it just changed. My sister did some paintings at the M11. She did some horses on the wall, but she never lived there.
Right. And what was your... When you say you were thinking about making art and protests and making it as one, what were you thinking about when you were thinking about how that might happen, what that might be?
Well, I suppose I was thinking about art... Art giving strength to the protest. And, making protesting more interesting and colourful and making the event of the protest into more of a ritual, really.
Right. And had you thought about how that might happen?
Well, I was thinking about it. It was the things I've talked about to do with them. You know, using art to bond the group and the red ochre thing, you know, bonding the group. And then the combination of red ochre bonding the group but also being repulsive. And I was also, in the stuff I'd done to do with ritual, do you know stuff to do with like feminist spirituality, like Starhawk and people like that? Okay, well, Starhawk is a witch. She went to Greenham Common, and she's done a lot of protests in America and stuff, and she's done a lot sort of investigating to do with the bonding of the group and the effects it has on security guards or whoever. And so it was after reading a lot of stuff by her and going to workshops by her, and I was trying to bring aspects of that in it too.
Okay.
So it was, you know, empowering the individual as part of the group. You know, how strong does singing make you? And how strong does being painted make you? Or
And did you see that as a continuation of, in a way, the work from the neo-naturists in some form?
I think I did. In me, it was a continuation of the work of the neo-naturists. It was my personal exploration of the neo-naturists rather than the neo-naturists as the group that we were back then, or as the group we might be if we were together as a group.
Right.
This was me taking it off on my own tangent, really.
Mm.
And probably, you know, as I was the person that really started the neo-naturist, there's probably elements of the same things in it, although I think I was much more subconscious about it in the neo-naturist era than I was then.
And can you think of any other artist's work that lived in the area of the time that you might have seen, and or do you...
Other artists that lived in the area? What do you mean? I think was part of the protest?
Just generally, or as part of the protest, well, or generally?
I think one of the reasons I did the art house was because I felt like the artists needed to be more involved in the protest.
Right.
They all seemed quite separate to me.
Right.
And living in their own little worlds and not really joining in the group. And so... that's one of the reasons the art house seemed like a good idea, was like just to give them a gallery space to put something in, to be part of it. And it was a kind of symbolic thing. Now I'm remembering, it was kind of like thinking the artists are here and they're powerful people, but they're not really in the protest. Mm. If they can bring something and put it in the protest, a bit of their art, it'll make the protest more powerful.
Mm.
It was from that way of thinking, right. Really.
And did any artist put into
it? Yeah, Grayson had a pot in the art house, but it got stolen.
Mm.
I blimey wish I'd kept it. I should have looked after it and had it myself. It'd be worth something now. And Mary did stuff in the art house.
Uh-huh.
And there were some other artists whose names I can't remember. Someone had done a piece of work that was lots of photographs of the individual houses all stuck together. Do you know that? Who's that by?
I'm not sure.
And that was in the house. Where it went, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's scary, the thought of where everything went.
Yeah.
That was in the house. And there was a woman that did a whole room that was about money going down the drain as part of the project. She did the bathroom. She painted the inside of the bath with a road and pound notes going down it and stuff.
Was she a protester or was she one of the
artists? She was a bit
artists?
Of a mixture like me, because she lived, in a way, people that lived in Claremont Road, they couldn't be separate in the end.
Mm.
They had to be part of it.
Mm.
Whereas the ones that lived along Grove Green Road and Dyers Hall Road, they were more separate.
Mm.
But if you were in Claremont Road, you had to join in. And the longer you were there, the more you had to join in.
Mm.
What's she called? She made mirrors. I've still got one of her mirrors, it's really nice. But, I can't remember what her name was. But there were, there were a few artists that joined in with the art house, but the artists all seemed quite separate to me, really.
Mm.
But I think I was a latecomer. So I didn't move there till, well, I can't remember when, but it was only, a few months before the protesting sort of started, or a year at the most. So, and I knew that the house was definitely going to be knocked down.
Yeah.
And I've never been much of a home improvements person anyway. So I knew there wasn't any point doing anything to the house.
Mm.
Yeah, and the protesting was the thing that just seemed the most interesting to me.
And did any of the protesters put into the art house as well?
Yeah, they did. I mean, I think protesters, they did put things into the art house, and they did other kind of creative things.
Mm.
And we did things sort of together as, things would just evolve. Like,
yep.
There was this car outside the art house that someone had pulled in, and we filled it up with earth as part of making a barricade.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone planted grass on top of it, and then someone else painted yellow lines around it. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, it needs a finishing touch. So in red ochre, I wrote Rust in Peace on it.
Oh, yes.
So, and then, it's kind of like a group thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if any of those people would have considered themselves as artists, but a piece of art was created.
Mm. You saw that as art,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And then do you think at that period of time maybe, or do you think that period of time has influenced any of your subsequent work?
Well, how it's influenced my work in a kind of off a tangent sort of way, and that is I'm now a sustainable transport officer in my day job. So actually being a no roads protester gave me the interest in transport.
Mm.
Well, it was a combination of that and then continuing my anthropological interest and doing a degree in anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
and doing a lot of investigation to do, because I wanted to actually do stuff to do with body painting in my anthropological degree, but I ended up doing stuff to do with the Fire Festivals of East Sussex, because they paint their faces, because I wanted to do field research. And but it all turning out to be really interesting and to do with the hierarchy between carnival and pageant.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And how carnival is connected to protest.
Mm-hmm.
So all that stuff about the streets, basically, yeah. Claiming the streets and, you know, all that angle of it. That carried on through going to university and doing my dissertation about carnival and pageant and the Fire Festival in Sussex, and then becoming an arts officer, but then realising actually it's quite, there's not much potential for doing art as an arts officer. I became the arts and heritage officer for Harrow Council, and it was sort of facilitating art.
Right.
But that if you're trying to get funding for art from arts bodies, they're really picky.
Mm.
If you call it something else, like transport, there's so much more potential for doing art. then I came to work for SEA in Kennington to do environmental projects, and I've ended up doing transport, and now I do quite a lot of street audits and, you know, just stuff to do with the streets. Mm. And it's nothing to do with neo-naturism. I mean, it's nothing to do with body painting or anything. But it is to do with people bonding as a group. Being on the street and looking at the street in a new way.
Mm.
Looking at the hierarchy between people and cars. And sort of visioning how it can be better.
Right.
Which I think all these things feed into, really.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say, and I think there's probably other ways it's come into my art. But I just do so many different things. And I find it difficult to know what I'm doing, which is art and what isn't art. But that's, I've always okay. been like that, because it's sort of like, you know, when I was doing protesting, sometimes I might think it was art, sometimes I might not. Or I might even know that it was or not.
Mm.
And when I'm in my doing my day job, sometimes I feel like it's art, sometimes I don't. And, you know, and there are different angles it goes off at where it kind of becomes art more than others, and whether it is or not, I don't even know.
But that's what's interesting, is it? I mean,
yeah, I suppose it is in a way. Yeah, it is. When I think of it in terms of the M11, the artists in their houses seemed very limited in the scale of the whole thing that was going on.
Mm.
They seemed sort of not want to see,
right.
somehow. They seemed as if they could only dip in and out quite briefly. They couldn't really engage with it. And I suppose, that's what I was much more wanted to do, was like fling myself. That's kind of, I suppose that is what I do, is, you know, just fling myself into things.
Mm.
And probably lose the plot quite often.
I'm sure not. Shall we take a pause
here? Yeah, engineers. Mm. Or, you know, to work on building skyscrapers and stuff. The women in their lives put menstrual blood on the ground at the four corners of where they're working to protect, as a protection for the men. So I'd heard this idea, and I just thought it was such a great idea, and this was my version of the idea. And it was good, because we did knock the fence down that day. And one of the people who helped knock the fence down was this fantastic old woman. Oh, she was so lovely. She had loads of dogs. She was at the protest with a couple of little dogs on leads, a black plastic Mac, sort of 60s plastic Mac. She was about 70 or 80 and had white hair and a hairnet and some kind of funny little kinky boots. And I saw her, and she was writing on the fence in Biro her little message of protest. And then she had her umbrella, and she was going, she was pushing the fence with her umbrella. And then when it came down, she was so excited. It was fantastic. And so the fence did come down that day. I don't know if it had anything to do with my menstrual blood or not, but.
So that was in Wanstead.
Mm.
And there were a number of events that happened in Wanstead,
yeah.
Like the chestnut tree.
Yeah.
And there was the there's a campaign office as well.
Mm.
And I just wonder if you viewed some, how you viewed some of what the protesters did, some of the actions they did, what you thought about
that. I thought they were brilliant. I loved it. And, you know, I was there. I stayed up all night in the house waiting for the police to come and chained myself to the tree and got pulled out of it by policemen. And I was in the Evening Standard being pulled out of where was it? One of the big houses in Wanstead. We all stayed in it. Well, we waited in the campaign headquarters till we knew the police were coming.
Mm.
And then we all dashed along to the house to be inside the house ready for when the police came.
Mm.
And then we all just got pulled out individually. And it was very important that I had my lipstick on for that moment. The red ochre symbolism of lipstick, you see. And I made sure I got dressed up for the protests.
Okay.
And so, I was very pleased to be in the Evening Standard being pulled out, looking quite dramatic by policemen. And I used to enjoy doing singing with people while we were waiting for the police to come.
Right.
And it was good because otherwise people just got too bored. And it was part of my thinking about helping make people stronger and making it an enjoyable occasion, a bonding occasion.
Mm. And do you feel that had a relationship at all with some of the neo-naturists or your relationship with the neo-naturists as well?
Yeah, I think it did because I mean, one of the things the neo-naturists did for me was make me realise most of your fears to do with people are imaginary.
Mm.
And that you can, well, maybe that's the reason I did the neo-naturist in the first place, but that if you're with a group of people, you know, there's lots of things you can do to occupy yourself. It's silly just getting all agitated and serious when it's a symbolic act.
Yeah.
And you might as well be singing or, you know, doing something to pass the time so you're having a good time.
Mm.
So I did quite a lot of cheerleading in that kind of way as part of the protest, was encouraging singing. And I encouraged painting as well. I did used to take, body paints with me, but people only painted their faces, really.
Right.
And I used to get disappointed because I never managed to persuade people to do body painting, but I quite soon realised it was a bit of a waste of time and that wasn't really the point. But I used to love it. Like, I just felt, to me, all the protests felt like art. I felt like I was at an art event.
Right.
Those sort of moments, like when Paul Marozzo, have you heard of Paul Marozzo? Mm. When he jumped, he was on the chestnut tree,
yeah.
And they brought a cherry picker along, and he jumped onto the cherry picker, and he was sort of climbing all over it, and it was just wonderful. It was like, you know, who needs the pictures? This is fantastic. This is real life.
Mm.
And he was just my hero after that. And all those things that people did, you know.
Mm.
And then just being in these kind of weird environments that are created by the knocking down of houses.
Right.
Weird kind of muddy plots with some kind of like crane or bulldozer or something on it.
Mm.
And, you know, with like about 10 muddy protesters and 10 muddy policemen and a few workmen. And there's some kind of weird battle going on between all of you. That, you know, those moments I thought were really magical and scary, but it was just, you know, it was just, yeah, those sort of places and moments that were created by this whole process of the road coming and people protesting about it. I really enjoyed all of that.
Mm. And the relationships that you built up, are they things which have been retained, or in terms of context, but also in terms of your attitude or view to people as well?
Well, I think they've become part of my attitude or views. I mean, in the end, as you go through life, things happen and they become part of your picture, don't they? And then you move on and then something else tempers it or whatever. So it's part of that. But I think an example of the bonding of the M11 experience, it must have been about 5 years after it, or, you know, quite a long time after the M11, there was a protest in London, and it was something to do with, do you remember Reclaim the Streets? You used to do taking over the street things, and it was in Tottenham.
Yeah,
they did one in Tottenham, and I think we all had to meet at King's Cross or something, and then we were all going to get on the tube, and then they closed the tubes.
Right.
So there we were, stuck in King's Cross, and we had to get to Tottenham. And in my mind, I thought, well, you know, we can walk to the next station. And there were a few people there. My ex-partner Jason was there, who was also a protester. And there were just a few people around that I probably hadn't seen since. Probably might not have even known their names, but I knew they were protesters at the M11. And I just said, well, let's walk. And so we just started walking, and I could just about remember the way, and I did have to kind of lead the way. But in that way where you're sort of walking through the streets and there's police around and you're with a load of people that have just come along something like that for the first time and don't know where they're going, and they might be a bit pissed or on drugs, or and then there's members of the public and there's cars, and there are all kinds of things that might happen. And I can remember that as we were walking, there were certain people that, and I, we only had to look at each other and we knew what to do. It was like, because we'd had the experience of the protest, we knew the ways, you know, how to be and what to do. And it was only a look. And I just remember there was just a few moments where there was just a glance and you knew what to do. And we did. We walked all the way to Tottenham. And it was fantastic arriving after walking from King's Cross with like about, you know, a couple of thousand people behind you, or however many there were. It was brilliant. And then arriving, there's all samba bands and everything. It's fantastic. That felt like art.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. And so do you feel that...
So the reason I said that was because that was to do with relationships and contacts.
Yeah.
It was to do with the bonding.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that, you know, if I went to something now and there were some of those familiar faces there and something kicked off or something, as they'd say... Mm. We would know kind of what was going on and what to do. And I think that's kind of what confounded the police in a way. Because I think there was kind of... The police actually thought that I was one of the leaders of the campaign. They thought that the house I lived in with Mary and Graham was the headquarters of the campaign.
Yeah.
And they actually smashed the door down.
Right.
And they took me and Mary and their disabled son.
Mm.
And they locked us up for the whole day. And it was false imprisonment. We never did them for it. And I was looking through a hole in the door to see what they were doing. And they were in my bedroom and they filmed everything. They filmed my passport. They filmed my address book and then they stole it. And there was a photocopier in my bedroom, a broken photocopier, and they must have somehow known it was there, because I think that's what made them think it was the headquarters, because there was a photocopier. But it just... And they filmed all... And I had all these little leaflets about things that I was interested in, like goddess workshops and sort of massage, menstrual rituals and things. And they were filming all of them.
Extraordinary.
And they thought our house was the headquarters. And it's funny because a couple of nights before it happened, I had this weird dream that there were all these policemen with guns pointing towards the M11. And then in my dream, they all sort of swivel around and pointed towards our house. And then a couple of days later, that happened. That was me. That's the day I left for good.
Really?
Because they bulldozed our house down the same day.
Really?
Yeah, they broke in. They smashed the door down.
Right.
Broke the door down. The dog ran away. I don't know what happened to Graham. But me, Mary and Gabriel were just locked in this room with a policeman guarding us. And he even came to the toilet with us, or came up when we went to the toilet. I think there were a couple of policemen. One of them would sort of stand outside the toilet when we were having a wee. And then I think they kept us there for the morning. And then they said they wanted to bulldoze the house down that day, and we had to get everything out. And it was just a house full of stuff. Artworks, Mary's glass sculptures, Graham's tapes of, you know, all his recording studio. And we had to move it out in an afternoon and find somewhere to put it.
How much time did you have?
About 4 hours.
My word.
And luckily I have my Peabody flat that I'd already gotten. A friend was staying in it, so I could just take everything there. And I didn't have that much stuff in that house because I'd already been evicted from Dietal Road.
Right.
But I knew the eviction date for that, so I could plan for it. For this, it was just like 20 policemen bursting through the doors with what are those things called?
Truncheons.
With truncheons and stuff. And then having the afternoon to get out. And I think Mary and Graham got storage for their stuff. They just booked some sort of storage place and put it all in storage. But then that evening, we actually watched them bulldozing the house down.
In that
morning, we'd been sitting there having breakfast.
What was that like?
It was a night. Well, it was.
It was to watch them bulldoze down the house.
Well, it was just incredible. It just made me realise the term "as safe as houses" means nothing. Because actually, a bulldozer can just come along and knock it down.
Yeah. And did you stood there and watched it when Graham and
well, you had to really. And I'd only been there for probably less than a year, I think between 6 months and a year. But Graham had been there for years and years and years, and I was sort of staying there because I'd already been evicted from one place, so it wasn't as bad for me as it was for them. But I think one of the reasons that they did it was because we filmed the protest from the window
of Graham's house.
Yeah, right. And it was when it was that big Claremont Road eviction.
Yeah,
and there were hundreds of police, and it was kind of like the Planet of the Apes. You know, the sort of marching, you know, huge gangs of. It was like that, all these glinting helmets and everything. Mm. And to me, it just seemed incredible that when they showed it on the telly, all they showed was a few scruffy protesters on a roof. Whereas there was this huge dramatic spectacle going on that they didn't show at all.
It wouldn't fit in, maybe.
No, and so, well, would kind of spoil their sort of little view of the few scruffy protesters on the roof. And so it needed filming.
Mm.
But I think, I'm not sure if it was with Graham's camera I filmed it, or if it might have been with Neil's camera, or...
Right.
And Paul Marozzo came to stay there a couple of nights as well, and he used that house as a bit of a base to go up and down the railway line.
Okay.
To get to different places.
And do you think maybe that had an influence on
the police came through? Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know.
That was from Grove Green Road, that eviction.
Yeah.
And with Dyers Hall Road... You were evicted from there. How did that happen? What were the events surrounding that?
Well, we knew the date.
Right.
And I did want to make it into more of a big kind of protest thing and get people to move in and squat it and everything. Mm. But by then the Claremont Road thing was starting, and I think everyone had decided there had to be a sort of stronghold in one place.
Right.
So it was just best to let the other places go and just concentrate on Claremont Road. So basically I just knew they were coming on a certain date. I moved everything out, painted all the walls with red ochre slogans and left.
And did they knock down the house?
Yeah.
What happened to it? Or did it stand
They
there
knocked
empty?
Down that house. I don't think I watched them knock it down, though. I think I just went one day and it was down. I think they knocked it down straight away.
Mm.
I think they knew better than to leave them empty by then.
So no squatters got in?
No,
there was no sort of exchange
anyway? No. I mean, I did do a lot of things like rushing into houses and trying to squat them, you know, almost having fights with them. Squibbs and Davis, that was it. Squibbs and Davis, they were the demolition men.
Oh, okay.
From West Ham, with West Ham colours on their trucks. And actually a squib became a term. I mean, the term squib was used a lot in the local pubs as like a baddie.
Right.
And I think that kind of all came from Squibbs and Davis, really.
Mm.
But, I did a lot of trying to squat places in dramatic ways, like rushing into houses with whole gangs of protesters, and you know what, when the Squibbs and Davis happened to be outside, and just trying to close the door and not let them get back in and things like that.
Were any successful?
Oh. The particular one I'm thinking of wasn't successful, probably because I was the one that was trying to close the door. But I think some of them were.
Was the Dyers Hall Road was Acme?
Yeah.
Owned house. Mm. And then the Grove Green Road was Acme as well, through Graham?
Yeah, yeah, they were both Acme.
Right, okay. I'm just going to pause this. I'll get some more water.
No, fine.
And you talked a little bit about Graham and Mary, but who can you recall living around you? Maybe both at Dyers Hall Road and Grove Green Road, sort of artists and communities or protesters. And
I can't remember people's names. And there were artists living on either side of me in Dyers Hall Road, and I can't remember either of their names. The man on one side was a potter. The man on the other side, I'm not quite sure what he did, but he had ME, and he used to go out every night in the garden with a torch and pick up all the snails in the garden. I can't remember either of their names anymore.
Right.
Lisa was the woman that made mirrors and did the bathroom at the art house. Have you interviewed her or heard of her?
No.
Right, okay. And then there was Christine Chittuck. Have you heard anyone talk about her? She lived on Grove Green Road, and I think she still actually lives there because her house wasn't knocked down.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. She'd be a good person to talk to. And I've probably still got her address somewhere in one of my old address books.
And what was her involvement?
Well, she was an artist, and she was sort of slightly a protester, but not one as much as I was. And she knew quite a few of the other artists.
Mm.
And her house, miraculously, was just missed. But now she lives right next to a motorway. And I don't know if she still lives there or not.
Justice or something.
I think she might still live there. But if she'd... And I think she got the opportunity to buy it, which would be another reason that she might have stayed.
Mm.
But it's just a very peculiar position to end up in.
Mm. I'm sure.
Who else was there? Graham and Mary were my main ones. And the house next to them, I think, did Cornelia Parker used to live in it?
Maybe.
And... or maybe next door but one. But I didn't know that many of the artists. I sort of wanted to.
Mm.
But they kind of just seemed quite separate. like I talked about before.
In terms of local community that lived around you, can you recall any of the local community?
Not really. It was mainly the squatters and protesters that I knew. And I, you know, and say someone like Christine Chittuck, I would say she was local community and she was an artist and she was a protester. That's probably why I think she'd be a good person for you to talk to. Because I didn't really feel like there were met that many people that interacted with all the groups.
Yeah.
Oh, and then there were also, I mean, in the pub, the Northcote was the pub over the road, and we used to go there quite a lot. And Christine was friends with this sort of gang of lads, and I got to know them too. And they were quite funny. They were these four men that were kind of like, they were a bit like a kind of comedy act in a way. These four black men, all kind of different shapes and sizes, that used to spend an awful lot of time just hanging out in the pub. One of them was Junior. One of them was Chris. And then there's a little short, fat one, and I can't remember his name. They didn't join in with the protest at all. Or the artists. They were separate. They just went to the pub and talked about. Not their families, or maybe moaned about their families and the old woman, and played pool and.
Mm.
Maybe I can remember talking to them about things like whether they carried knives or not.
Right.
But, and they thought it was all a bit bonkers, the protest.
And what about people, local community, maybe on Claremont Road?
Well, by the time I was involved in Claremont Road, it was all protesters and squatters, really. Oh, there was an old lady called Dolly that lived there, who became like a kind of symbolic mascot. And but she was a protester, really, because she'd stayed. She'd dug her heels in and stayed, so she'd kind of become a protester.
Right, by default.
Yeah, and she was kind of open to it. She was open to the spirit of it. And I felt very sorry for her, though, because... You know, she lived in that nice little road by the railway line that was kind of quite quiet and leafy.
Mm.
And it would have been a very nice place to just live your days and die.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, in her 80th year, after probably having been born in the house, she had to move. And, you know, as I get older, I realise that this is true, but they say the older you get, the harder you can adapt to change.
Mm.
And I think she died not that long after she moved. And I'm not surprised. And it's sort of like she lived in this nice, peaceful place, and suddenly all these squatters and people appeared who were very nice to her some of the time, and then some of them were probably, you know, she probably had to put out really loud music, but I think she was quite deaf, so it might not matter. But then suddenly there were millions of people around, you know, and I can just remember her house always was a bit of a focus somehow, because she was a member of the community. And everyone, there were loads of people trying to be nice to her, sort of a bit creepy, really.
Mm.
And I just felt sorry for her, because I don't think that's really what she wanted. Mm. Although I think she did enjoy the attention, but... And it, I suppose when you, you know... It was a really interesting thing to happen to you suddenly when you think you're just going to live in the same house and die in it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, she did have to move. And I think they moved, she might have... I can remember hearing these stories, and it was all quite depressing about what happened to her, but I can't remember exactly what it was. There was a woman called Kathy.
Oh, right.
I think she was one of the artists. And I think she really took Dolly on. And someone was saying something about her the other day. And my friend Roz, who works at SEA where I work, she lives in Leytonstone now.
Okay.
I didn't know her then. But she knows a few of the artists from around that are still kind of around. And she, I think she said Kathy just disappeared one day and no one ever knew where she went. She just got really depressed and disappeared. So, and I think she used to do illustration or something like that. I think she was quite a sort of conventional artist.
And do you remember much about the number of people that came in to document the whole event?
Yeah, there were people. There was a lot of photography and stuff going on and video cameras and things. And you did sort of wonder who the people were. And there was always this thing like, well, is that one a policeman? Or is that one a policeman? You never really trusted someone with a camera.
Right, I'm sure.
Yeah, I remember suspecting that Neil might have been a policeman
really?
At one point, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I remember suspecting that perhaps that James and John from Platform were policemen. And in fact, most people I ever saw with a camera or being interested, I suspected they might be a policeman.
Suspicious.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that period of time and just thinking about whether that's something which might ever be repeated, could ever possibly happen again. Those sorts of communities coming together, artist communities coming together in one place and the changes that happen in the area.
I'm sure it could happen again, but in a different sort of way. Because these things do just happen, don't they? And it could never happen again.
Yeah.
But something with the same spirit could, I'm sure. But maybe I just think that because I'm a positive person. Because you can't kind of predict how things are going to happen.
No.
And things like that must happen again. Otherwise we're all dead, really.
Right.
Because you just need those things to happen. And it was that there was an aspect of it that was, you know, some of the old people that were involved in it, that were the more kind of local people. Oh, I suppose another member of the community I can remember was the woman, the lollipop lady. But for me, it's hard to differentiate between protesters and members of the community.
Yeah.
Because the people I got to know were all, it was all through the M11.
Yeah.
So therefore they were protesters to me, but they might have always lived there or lived there for ages.
Sure.
But people used to talk about the spirit of the Blitz, and that particularly that old lady that I talked about with the dogs. And I can remember sitting, because there were often fires at night, you know, sitting around a fire after a protest or waiting for the police to come or something, and you'd just sit round all night long. And they'd sort of talk about the Blitz and say, oh, yeah, well, this is bringing people together, isn't it? It's like the Blitz, oh, yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, disasters do pull people together. And I'm sure we've got lots of disasters in store for this planet, so they'll be pulling people together like nobody's business.
Absolutely. I was just thinking also, were you subletting then when you were living in the area?
Yeah, I was subletting off of Grayson.
Right. For Hannah?
Or maybe I wasn't subletting. I might not have even been paying him any rent, actually. I think I was just living there for free.
And you're in Dyers Hall Road for how long?
I think I was probably there for a couple of years.
And then to Grove Green Road for...
Yeah. Probably somewhere between 6 months and a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to get my diaries out and have a look. I can't remember the dates and how long.
Okay. I'm just going to do that. all yeah. that working together.
Okay.
So maybe you can just say a bit more about your involvement with the protesters and your art and how they actually worked together.
Okay. Well, I think one of the things to say about the protesters, and that is, as we've been talking, I really realised that I did come in quite late. I wasn't one of the established ACME artists. And I didn't know that many people when I moved there. Mary and Graham were the main people I knew. And then I got involved in the protest. So, you know, the protest was my community. And as I was, it sort of led on from my thinking about bonding and ritual and the anthropology stuff that I was thinking about. It was just sort of perfect for me, really, to experiment with all that stuff in that environment. And now I've said that, I've kind of forgotten exactly what your question was, but I know it was about those things.
Yeah, it was sort of the idea of, or how you saw the art that you were making and art in general and the protests, and how you felt they really, if they worked together and how they worked.
I feel like the protest gave me the opportunity to explore certain aspects of my art. That were, you know, the sort of red ochre, protesty, bonding type of aspects. And I think the, and I loved the sort of performative aspects of the stuff that was going on, the event, the whole protest as an event. And the sort of stuff that was created by that happening. And I think by the combinations of people who were there, you know, who weren't, and I was there as an artist, and then people like Tom came along as really in, you know, in it. And then there were, you know, there were other people around. I think Lisa was quite involved in the protest. But even if we hadn't been there, I still think that that whole, the environment that was created, that protest environment, was a creative environment. It inspired people to, you know, write, make banners and want to brighten, you know, make things look nicer. Or, and also, you know, because all these places were going to be knocked down, and it was like, you know, there was a road, but it wasn't a road anymore. It was, you know, thinking of Claremont Road. So you could just sort of paint on the road, or you can paint your own yellow lines. And, and I think that the creativity of that environment kind of led people to become artists, really. One of the men who lived on Claremont Road, who was a protester, he was called Old Mick, different person to Scouse Mick. And Old Mick, I would see him as an artist. I mean, one day I was sitting in one of the back gardens with him, and there was a fire. And I said, "Oh, I need a hammer," just in a conversation. He went, "Oh, okay." And he stood up, and in the fire, there was a hammerhead. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I put that in to burn the old handle off." So he chucked it into the fire to get rid of the old handle. And he just went and got a bit of wood, and he made a handle for the hammer, and he gave it to me, and I still got it. It's my hammer, and it's a really good hammer. It's really big. And he, I've got a sculpture he made that's like a, it's a piece of wood, but it looks sort of like a wing. And I think he made it of an old bit of the chestnut tree. And I'm not sure he, I'm not sure if he would be in your list of artists, and he's dead anyway. And have you heard about his funeral?
No, not at all.
And he died a few years ago. And my ex-partner's a tree surgeon, and he stayed in contact with a lot of the people, probably more than I did in a way. the more protestory and squattery ones. And anyway, old Mick died, and when he died, he lived in a squat with some of the protesters that were still all together and squatting. When he died, they didn't tell the hospital or the police or anything. They put him in the freezer. And they decided that to burn him, to have their own pyre. So they, Jason got loads of the wood, and they took him off to the woods in Kent, and they had this huge event. And they put him on the pyre and burnt him. And I couldn't go for some reason. It's because I was the Arts and Heritage Officer at Harrow Council. I had some event the next day. And that's one of my regrets in life. And they burnt him. And I think, if, you know, if a couple of thousand people turned up, or a lot of people, you know, maybe not thousands, but a lot. And they had, you know, they had him there on display, and people put flowers on him and wrote little messages to him. And people got dressed up and wore and gave little speeches and things. And a couple of people even have an argument about, they didn't agree about something or other, or they didn't get on, and they were both talking. And this is all reported via Jason.
Right.
And then they put him on the pyre, on a huge pile of wood, and they burnt him, and they just had a party while they watched him burn. And that is so in the true spirit of the anarchy of those people that, in a way, they've got that dedication, you know, to actually value him that much.
Yeah.
In fact, I can hardly say it without wanting to cry, because I just find it really moving that something about that they are...
Do you want to stop for a minute?
I don't really know why I'm crying. It's something about... the way that all the people kind of got bonded so much that they, you know, and he was like an East End, he came from sort of East End criminal family and he'd been in prison and stuff. And I think they actually invited his family, but they just, and then he'd become a protester, and he was a bit of a kind of wide boy type of person, but, you know, older and wiser. It just would have sort of ruined his life in a way to just join in with the system once he was dead. And so it was like a celebration of not being in the system completely, to actually have your own pie. And apparently a couple of policemen came along during the event, like a handful of policemen, and sort of went, what's going on here? We hear you're burning a body. And all the people there just went, piss off, and they did.
And what was the outcome?
Well, the outcomes. What do you mean?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm not sure you can do that.
It's illegal.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but they did. And when the policemen came along, they just told them to piss off, and the policemen did. It's sort of like power in numbers.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, power in numbers and ritual, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's truly amazing.
Yeah,
story.
It is. So he's someone that I would, you know, he was like the sort of nitty gritty type of artist of the M11, who sort of, he inspired that in people, that when he died, they did that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, out of the protest of the M11, things like that happened. And I think that's a very powerful act.
For sure.
Mm.
It's fascinating. Maybe we should stop there.
Yeah, maybe we should. It seems like a bit of an ending point.
Yeah.